I'm Ahmet Alpbalkın. I'm with Microsoft in Microsoft Azure Linux team. Thanks for coming in. Welcome. This is my Twitter handle. If you guys are not following, maybe you should. So if you look at the top contributors page on Docker, that's like me on the top left. And so we're going to start with some news. Who has heard about the Microsoft Nano Server? That's pretty good. Okay. So Microsoft Nano Server is a small piece of hardware that we are running in our data centers. So you can put only one container in it. So who just believed that? Nobody. Okay, good. So it is a minimal Windows Server distro, as I call it. And it is like super small. It is still an operating system, but like trimmed down version of Windows Server, and it's like 93% smaller in the disk size, and it boots like super fast, and you get less reboots because there is nothing to update, and since there is nothing to update inside the OS, we don't really reboot you for security updates. So there is no graphical user interface stack. As I said, we basically cut down so many things on Windows Server, and there is no 32-bit support. All you need to do is like remotely manage the server you have through PowerShell or Windows Management Instrumentation. No SSH, sorry. And it's like super ideal for containers, running containers, and web server workloads. It is designed to run applications on cloud. That's why it is like one of those minimal Linux distributions like CoreOS, RancherOS, or like VMware's Photon recently came out. So you might be wondering, when is this thing coming out? It is coming out soon. All right. So what's next? Hyper-V containers. Who has heard about Hyper-V containers? Very little. I can understand that. So Hyper-V containers are basically the product we have. They are still Hyper-V. We are leveraging our virtualization experience in Windows Server area, and we are applying them to run containers. And what we provide with Hyper-V containers is full isolation between containers. So you just spun up some VM on Azure, and that VM is running like 100 containers, and all these 100 containers are guaranteed to be fully isolated, fully secure, and no container can mess up with some other container running on the same VM or physical machine. So when you look at it, the picture is probably not really good. I need to explain it, sorry for that. So there is this Windows Server kernel running in the very bottom, and then you can have like regular Windows processes or regular Windows Server containers. And then if you want to go like real secure, let's say you have different workloads from different customers running in your VM. So you are basically using your VMs to pool workloads coming from your customers. And you don't want your customers to mess up with each other's workloads or see each other's secrets. So in order to do that, you can just put your container in a Hyper-V virtualization environment, and then all you need to do is going to be, you're just gonna run some Docker commands against Windows Server, and it's supposed to just work right out of the box. Okay, when is this coming out? Soon. We don't really say when it's going to come out because the development is still going on very heavily. And we have Build and Ignite conferences in 1 week, I guess. And they're probably going to talk about both Nano Server and Windows Server containers and Hyper-V containers in those conferences. But if you really want to see what is going on, like there is a small URL at the bottom. I'm not sure if you can see that from the back. It's like github.com/Microsoft/Docker. If you look at the branches over there, we have something going on. I think they're pretty close to getting Docker working against Windows Server containers, which is not out yet, but I think they're still trying to prepare a demo. And what's going to happen next is they're going to delete that hacky code again and start from scratch with a very high quality code. We do that all the time. And so the next thing is Docker clients for Windows. Who has heard about such a thing before? Way more, that's great. So it all started back in November. We sent a pull request to Docker saying, hey, this is the Windows port of Docker client. Obviously, it was not the whole thing, but we got it compiling. At least, like, you can compile Docker on your Windows machine, and you can run some Docker commands like Docker PS, Docker run against your Linux engine running Docker. And then fast forward 3 months, we basically sent, it's not really readable, but we sent, this is actually just me, we sent around 80 pull requests in February and March to get this working. Most of it was tests. It wasn't really a product. It wasn't really the product code. The bug fixes were less than we expected. And then last week, we made the Docker client for Windows available for everybody to download. It looks like this. So if you just run Docker exe, it successfully prints the help message. That's true. And if you're, you know, if you don't know what to do with it, you can actually print Clippy to your screen, just in case you don't have Office 97 installed. All right. Okay. So with Docker 1.6, we released a technical preview, what we call it, of the Docker Windows client. So just try it out. Open bugs on Docker's issue tracker on GitHub, and the plan for Docker Windows client is to provide a common experience. It is going to run, it is going to be used to manage Windows, it's going to be managed to manage the Linux Docker engine today, but when the Windows containers come into the picture tomorrow, they're gonna manage the Windows Docker container engine. So the plan is to provide the same management experience on both platforms using Docker. So how do I download it? So there is this thing called Chocolaty Package Manager. It is a community project. It's basically like an apt-get for Windows. You just can install it with one command. Just you just paste the command in your CMD or PowerShell. It just runs, installs Chocolaty. And then you run the small command like Chocolaty install Docker. You get Docker on your machine. So I have a tutorial about this uploaded on Docker's YouTube account. It is like I talk all the time, and it is 90 seconds, less than 90 seconds. Anyway, so the way it looks like, the method two is downloading boot to Docker. Who have used boot to Docker before? Awesome. So boot to Docker is, so we changed boot to Docker to ship a Docker client for Windows, the Docker exe, and then it creates a Linux VM, which is something called TinyCore Linux, and it just has a daemon, Docker daemon running in it, and then using the Docker Windows client, you can talk to the Docker engine running inside a VirtualBox on your laptop directly. So in order to download boot to Docker, you just go to boot to Docker.io. There is a like very simple installation wizard, like all Windows programs. You just click next, 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 and it installs. It puts you in a shell prompt. It's probably not easy to read, but like there is this shortcut icon. If you click, just give me a Docker, and then it gives you a Docker prompt. You can run Docker PS or directly run your containers. So the next thing I'm gonna talk is, how are we gonna deploy Docker on Azure? Most of you are developers, you probably know how to do that. But there are far too many ways to do it. So this is most people, I think, tend to do. You just provision a Docker VM on Azure, and you SSH into the VM. There is this curl get docker.com pipe sh. I know it's not a good idea. You should also probably put an HTTPS. I forgot to put it. So anyway, this will get you the latest Docker version on your machine. So the next thing is we have something called Azure Marketplace. It's like Amazon.com for developer products. You just go there, you choose what you want to get, and we have this nice Ubuntu image with Docker installed in it. You just say, hey, I want this URL. Give me a VM running on this public IP, and then you give just your SSH key, and it creates a Docker daemon inside an Ubuntu VM for you, but you cannot really connect to that Docker instance because you don't upload your certs. You know, Docker has this complicated cert mechanism, but you know, we're gonna make it easier. So this brings us to the next solution, which is Docker Machine. Docker Machine is a little tool made by Docker engineers. It is used to create Docker-ready instances on several cloud platforms or on your laptop. So you run some little command, you say, hey, I want a Docker machine, created on Azure. Here's my subscription ID. Here's my management certificate. I want this username. Just create this VM for me. And in a few minutes, we create SSH certificates for Docker. We upload the certificates to the Docker instance. We configure the Docker instance properly. And we just give you a shell prompt where you can directly talk to the Docker instance you just created on the cloud. So the next solution is to use Azure CLI. We have so many ways. It is basically this, pretty much the same thing, but compared to the Docker machine, what Docker machine does on several cloud platforms is to run the curl get docker-com pipe sh, which is installing Docker basically on regardless of the platform. But Azure CLI is provisioning an Ubuntu VM for you or a CoreOS VM for you. You just, again, say, hey, here is my username or password, or you can give SSH key, and then you can use SSH to connect to the instance. Hey, I want this in this location. Here's the size, whatever. It just creates it for you. And it is ready to use after creating. So we have this very new way. I'm not supposed to talk about it, I think. So this is not out yet, but if you search for it, I think you may find something. This is Azure, what we call as Azure templates. And Azure templates are basically a JSON way, type-safe JSON way. Many of you are not believing that. Type-safe JSON way of describing your entire VM and storage and network topology. And once you describe your topology, all you need to do is, hey, I have this VM, and I want to install Docker in it. This is the basically the extension, sorry, the publisher and the type does. Like, I want this Docker extension from MS OpenTech. I need to have this version. And you can give other sorts of stuff like, hey, I want Docker to be listening on this VM. I want certs to be uploaded to here. Hey, here are my certs. And you can say, and when you create the Docker instance, you can like spin up an Nginx instance and a Redis instance. So this is actually a Docker Compose YAML file, but it looks like JSON because we convert the JSON into YAML later on. And then you can actually do stuff like, hey, I just spun up this container and I just created this VM. I want to make this VM join to that Swarm ring. And then using Docker Swarm, which is an orchestrator on top of Docker engines, you can make your Azure VM joined to a set of Swarm hosts. Okay, so what's next? So these are our plans for the future. So the first thing is Docker Hub Mirrors. Who has heard about that Docker Hub Mirrors before? Almost no one. I can understand it. It's the super high-tech thing. Okay, so today, when you do a Docker pull on your, let's say, Mac or Windows or Linux machine, your Docker command line interface talks to the Docker engine you are running inside a VM. And once it talks to the VM, the Docker daemon goes to the Docker Hub and downloads the image from there for you. And actually, what I didn't put here in this image is there is a CDN in front of Docker's registry. So if I'm downloading some binary object, it is probably taking some time if the CDN is having a cache miss or something. So what Docker is planning to develop is Docker Hub Mirrors. So what do I do in this case is, sorry for the small text again. So when the client issues a Docker pull request, it goes to the Docker daemon, but Docker daemon has this flag called Register Mirrors. So it knows where it is going to ask to pull this image from. In this case, we are planning to launch a Docker Hub mirror, which behaves like a cache. It you know, has the semantics of cache hit and cache miss. So you're saying, hey, I have this Debian image. I want to download it. And when you ask for it to the, let's say, Docker mirror-vest.us.azure.com. So let's say this is going to be our Docker Hub mirror service. And if you get a cache hit from there, you know, we'll just serve you the content. And if we get a cache miss, we are going to hit Docker's CDN again, and Docker's CDN, if you know that gets a cache miss, it's going to hit Docker's actual blob storage, which is probably on S3, and then we are going to get our request back, but it's going to be like very slow. So what this provides is your network doesn't go out of the same data center. We are planning to launch Docker Hub mirrors on every single Azure region, which are 19. Once we launch that, your pull requests, your image pools are not going to leave the data center. And then since it's in the same data center, it is going to be fast, and you won't be billed for the traffic, and we are going to reduce the load on Docker's CDN so that Docker can get less bills from CDN. So this is going to be available with Registry 2.1. I think this is going to be like post-DockerCon. Actually, I probably need to talk about Docker Registry. So Docker Registry is the piece that gives you, that stores your Docker images, and when you say like Docker pull Debian, it provides you, it finds what the Debian image is, it pulls up some layers from the database, it serves you all these layers. So if you don't want to use Docker Hub, Docker made it very easy to deploy a separate Docker registry for you, and then you can host this Docker registry on Azure. So what we've done recently is to is writing the registry driver for Azure for Docker Registry 2.0, which has recently came out last week with Docker 1.6, and it is previously it was written in Python. I know you don't like it, but it has been rewritten in Golang, and then you know just with this five-line YAML file, you can say, hey, this is my storage on Azure. I want to just use this Azure storage account for my storing my Docker images. And then all you need to do is just build an image on top of Registry 2.0 image and run it. So I'm coming close to the end. It's been just 7 minutes, I can't believe it. Anyway, so we're going to talk about openness at Microsoft. I forgot to mention everything I wrote in the past 6 months has been open source. And it's not just Docker, I can guarantee you that. In the past few months, actually like probably in the past 12 months, we as a company, we announced that .NET runtime is going to be open source, and the compiler ecosystem and the libraries, the standard libraries, and or like bytecode translators with it. And then we open sourced ASP.NET, the TypeScript. We open sourced some cool frameworks like Orleans and some tools like Cordova, and all our Azure SDKs are open source. And I really forgot to mention, because I don't know, like there are hundreds of open source Microsoft repositories out there. We're probably doing way more open source than many other companies. So we also participate in the development of Docker in general. We participate in the design discussions. We participate in the orchestration plans. We participate in the open API designs. So some of the stuff we participate are, you know, open orchestration APIs, which are like, you know, command line interface, the remote API of Docker, and we contribute to the Docker core itself. It's not just the CLI part. We contribute to the Linux engine as well as the Windows engine. We are trying to improve Docker machine experience on Windows. We're trying to, you know, write Docker register plugins that's named Docker distribution, and we are gonna make Docker Compose work way better on Linux, on Windows and Linux. And lastly, there is boot to Docker. So this is pretty much the end. I was planning to get some questions. I hope you have questions. Is Microsoft planning to do more stuff for Golang? The answer is I think yes. So the current state of Go on Windows is, okay, there is something out there running. You can write Go programs that are running on Windows, for example, Docker. But there are some problems with it. So for example, if we try to do some system calls, low-level Win32 API calls, some of them are implemented, like the important ones, obviously like create file, read file, those are implemented. But if you try to go deep on the API set, like if you try to create a symbolic link, or if you try to read a link, which are heavily used in Docker, in the engine itself, those functionality, those stuff are not implemented properly or missing. So what we're planning to do is, most likely we are gonna have someone looking at the Go runtime and the standard library for Windows, and then we are probably going to be implementing some stuff for the Golang itself. And like seriously, internally the Golang usage has just skyrocketed, and I think something exciting is going to happen in that area. How do I do things on a Microsoft Nano server without using SSH, because there is no SSH. So the Yeah, so the answer is we are planning to provide this thing called, you know, these are all Microsoft stuff, so I won't blame you if you don't know about them, because I don't know very much. I don't know them very much either. They are going to use Docker shell. We are going to use PowerShell desired state configuration and WMI, what we call it, is Windows Management Instrumentation. But these are all like super old stuff, and I know that Linux people don't really like those tools. Personally, I just can't get familiar enough with the PowerShell myself. So I won't be surprised if Microsoft someday implements the SSH protocol for Windows. I really wouldn't be surprised, because that's the way we're going to. So I'm not really the expert to talk about, make comments about Windows Linux container security, but you know, we all know that there has been cases in the past that some processes can get outside of the container boundary if you are running the Docker engine as root, and like that's I guess what many people do in production today, because you have to run them as root. And what happens in that case is you may get security problems, you know, every now and then, because the underlying kernel support, underlying C group support may have some problems. But what Hyper-V is doing is, okay, there's this hypervisor running deep down in the operating system, and there's a like super tiny little kernel, the nano server, running on it. And then on the nano server, you can run your container. And when I say that, I think what I saw from the demo is there's something posted online. You can run thousands, I think they run like 1,020 nano servers on a regular Windows machine. So it is not really, it's like super slim. It has a very low footprint. That's pretty much it. So Hyper-V containers make use of the Hyper-V technology, which is the hardware virtualization. There is again a kernel, but it's like very slim, and then your containers are on top of it. That's how we're planning to achieve the full security between containers. So there are two types of containers. I know that they are confusing, but there are Windows Server containers, and there are Hyper-V containers, which are actually Windows Server containers running on Hyper-V. And what's going to happen is, we will have normal containers running on a bare Windows machine, or a Windows VM, Windows Server VM to be precise. And you will have those containers running on the same host, but we don't guarantee the security and the full isolation between them. So you better make sure that all those containers belong to you. It's gonna work like that. Well, thank you very much again. Thanks for listening.
So hi everybody, thanks very much for coming today, and I'm really glad to actually meet Amit in person. We've been at the same company for like 2 years I spent there, and that's the first time I meet him. My name is Patrick Chenazon, I work at Docker. I joined Docker only 6 weeks ago, so it's pretty recent. And before that I was at Microsoft, so I spent 2 years at Microsoft. But before that, I spent my whole career competing with Microsoft. So I've been at Netscape, and AOL, and then at Sun, the network of the computer. Some of you may remember that. It's coming back with fury right now. Then I spent 6 years at Google in developer relations, and the last 2 years were on the cloud. So with this little platform called Google App Engine, it was really the start of the Google Compute platform. Then I moved to VMware, which was open sourcing PaaS with Cloud Foundry, and that was a lot of fun. And after they spun it off to Pivotal, I moved to Microsoft, and my first interview when I decided to move to Microsoft was with a guy named Satya Nadella, who later became CEO, and I remember coming back from that interview and telling my wife, hey, I'm probably going to join these guys, they seem to be changing. One of the things that very few people are aware of is that Satya is actually an ex-Sun guy. So all the, like, Microsoft loves Linux and all that, that's coming from far away. So I spent 2 years at Microsoft. It was really a lot of fun. My goal was to bring open source developers, people coming from the Java fold and from all open source communities I interacted with the years from Google to VMware, bringing them in the Microsoft ecosystem on Azure. And the thing that many people don't realize is that Microsoft has changed a lot. The wars of the past where Steve Ballmer called Linux cancer are really over. Now it's really Microsoft loves Linux. And the old fights like .NET versus Java are completely out of the picture right now. These are battles from 10 years ago, and these were fun to fight. But right now, the big fight is between the cloud platforms. And the three big cloud platforms are, today they're Azure from Microsoft, you have Google, and you have AWS. And it's a big fight between them. And Microsoft really wants all your workloads, whether you're using Linux or open source or .NET. And they are making lots of moves in that direction. Okay, so and just one fun thing. When I gave that talk for the first time, my friend Volker, who's in the DX team at Microsoft, he sent me that picture, like adding that that little red thing on top. It's like, because my talk, I'm going to talk today about orchestration systems for Docker on Azure. And when you start playing with Docker as a developer on your laptop, it's very easy. You get that the workflow, you really love it, you start playing with your colleagues and all that. And then one day you say, oh, we're going to go in production. And then you turn to your friendly ops guy, because you're doing DevOps, and you tell him, oh, I need to push all these containers in production on different clouds. I want a hybrid infrastructure for all this. And then you ask the problem of orchestration, and it's a real zoo in there. And so and when I say a zoo, it's an aquatic zoo, because the Docker logo is a whale. And so Volker said you're like the Commandant Cousteau, because I'm French, for the Docker ecosystem. So one of the reasons I joined Docker, and I don't know about you who the ones here who have started using Docker. When I started using it for the first time, after like a week or two of using it for different things, it started to grow on me, and I wanted to use it for more and more things, and it started to change the way I was thinking about how I build applications. And the thing it reminded me is the feeling I had in 1995 when Netscape 1.0 came out, and I started like playing with applications and building web applications. And I thought, wow, and at that time I was building client server or Lotus Notes applications. And I thought, wow, this new browser thing, maybe that's a new way for building applications. And then I spent the next 20 years of my career building these web apps and playing with that. So when I saw Docker appearing, to me it felt like the missing brick for building these microservices architectures that people like Netflix have pioneered in the cloud, but building their own stuff on top of infrastructure. And I think Docker kind of solved that problem really neatly and gives you a developer workflow and experience that as important as what the browser was 20 years ago? Yeah, I'm dating myself here. Before talking about the technology, I want to talk about the cloud market. So that's a slide I used to show to my team at Microsoft. So at Microsoft, I had several teams. One of the teams was focused on the IT pros, the ops. So they are going to conferences like TechEd, Ignite now. And then the other half of my team was more focused on developers and architects. And I showed them that picture showing how I understood the cloud market with movie analogies. So on the left, you have the IT pros who are building these private clouds. I'm sure many of you have heard about these. Maybe some of you are even helping people build them. on the private cloud side, it's really VMware with virtualization who won that market. Microsoft is making steady progress, like eating their market share with Hyper-V, which is getting better and better. And when I saw the numbers and the Gartner evaluations where VMware is going down and Microsoft is going up, to me the movie is 300. You know, they're very courageous, they shout Sparta, but we all know how the movie ends. It's very bad for these guys. So then on the other side of the spectrum, you have the public cloud providers, Google and Amazon. And so to me, Google, and I've been in these shoes, like being the Google guy who went to go to enterprises and said, hey, Mr. CIO, I have this wonderful platform as a service called Google App Engine. You just code your stuff, you push it to Google, and we scale it for you, we manage it for you. We don't need you anymore, by the way. And for your developers, it's going to be a whirlwind of productivity, but they need to abide by the restrictions that the platform places on you. So the developers said, hey, we don't want these restrictions. I want to run a lot of arbitrary stuff for building. I don't want you to limit me, but still I want to scale. And the CIO said, we want hybrid, so just bye-bye. And the feeling I had then is very well described in that movie Back to the Future, where, you know, that guy from the 80s, he's an adolescent from the 80s, he goes back in time in the 50s, and he goes on stage and he starts playing Van Halen and hard rock, and these guys are looking at him in a baffled way, and like, oh, what's this music from the future? I don't understand. And that's really the feeling I had at Google, where trying to pitch people some ideas and a product that just don't solve their problems today with no path to get there. And then you have Amazon. And to me, Amazon is really like that movie Pacific Rim. So they're the big monsters. They're coming out of a fault at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, and they're invading the enterprise market. And they need to be fought and put them back there. So that's Amazon. And in the middle, you have Microsoft. And Microsoft has a true hybrid cloud story. So Microsoft knows enterprises really well, but also Microsoft knows how to build scalable services because it has all these services from Hotmail, which is like 10 years old, to things like Halo, who needs to scale to thousands or tens of thousands of cores. And so Microsoft built this platform called Azure that's a public cloud platform, but at the same time, there's the equivalent of it called Azure Pack that you can that's based on Hyper-V, Windows Server, and System Center that you can run internally to build your own private cloud. And I think today Microsoft has the best hybrid cloud story between these four cloud providers. But what you see here, and so Microsoft to me is the field of dreams. It's like build it and they will come. And then in the middle of that big battle between the giants, I think I work at three of them. I haven't worked for Amazon yet. There's this little upstart called Docker that appeared in the landscape, and that came out with like these things called Linux containers, but in an easy way to use and with a very simple developer workflow. And that really changed the game. And I remember when I played with it, the first time I sent an email to Scott Guthrie saying, hey, you know these, you were worrying about the problem of density of workloads on Azure. You should take a look at this thing. It's really promising. And it seems to be taking off in Silicon Valley. And it really took off. And to me, Docker appeared in the market where the layers were already settled between infrastructure as a service where you provision VMs and platform as a service where you leave the control to the platform. And they came out with this notion of container that gives developers the flexibility to put whatever they need into their images to build their software and their microservices. And the ops gives the ops the control to orchestrate them the way they want. And in just a few years, or I'd say a year, it's really a year. Like the first year, there was traction that was starting to mount, but it's really in the past 12 months, the whole industry reorganized around this. And let me see, I think I have a slide about this ecosystem where at the bottom of it, you have the cloud providers who today, to me, that's the new hardware. So that's the metal where your stuff is running. And so in there, each of the players have their own strategy for Docker orchestration. So Google, they have Google Container Engine, it's called, and they open source piece of it that's called Kubernetes that works really well with CoreOS. And so you can see Google solving their hybrid cloud problem by saying, hey, you just use Container Engine to schedule your containers into the Google Cloud, and then you can use CoreOS and Kubernetes to just build your own private cloud. Then there's Amazon. I think Amazon, they still have a hybrid cloud issue, so they built this Amazon Container Service, I think it's called, but it's only on the public cloud side, and there's Eucalyptus, which is part of HP right now. So we have a Eucalyptus team member here. You should ask him questions if you want to know what Amazon hybrid cloud strategy is about, or what HP is doing about it. So Amazon, they had Eucalyptus that you'd install in private cloud, but then there's no equivalent for that Amazon Container Service. Then you have Microsoft, and as Ahmed told you, I think he showed you the whole breadth of investment of Microsoft in Docker. Basically, Microsoft understands developers. They understand IT pros as well, and they said, wow, this thing is the best thing since sliced bread, and we're just going to invest a lot from the company in it. And we like the workflow for developers so much that we're going to bring it to Windows so that Windows developers can use that workflow. Then you have other players like Giant, which is, so Giant was created by X people from Sun. It's all based on Solaris. If you look at the history of containers, like Solaris containers are from, I think, the years 2000, 2005, or something like that. So it existed. That notion of containers existing in mainframes already, and operating system level containerization, it existed in the 2000s for sure. But then what Docker did is that they made it very easy to consume. So you have people like Giant who are like refocusing their cloud offering, I think it's called SmartOS, which is based on Solaris, which is super powerful, but like running Solaris, and they just put a Docker frontend in front of it and re-implemented the Docker backend based on SmartOS. So you're just talking to a Docker host and you have all their data center behind it. Then you have VMware, who announced Project Photon like 2 days ago. So this slide deck, I have to redo it every 2 days. Like, I have to add stuff to it because the industry is moving so fast. It's really a fascinating period right now. On top of that, I would call that the new hardware layer, which are the cloud providers. You have the operating system layer, and there it's been dramatic. Like, really, in 1 year, all the big players in the Linux market, and actually Windows market as well with Nano Server, just shipped a minimal distribution that just runs Docker containers. So it started with CoreOS, who kind of invented the notion. They took the approach of what Chrome OS did from Google. They just applied it to the data center operating system. So it's a minimal Linux distro with just a Docker engine and a few services like etcd or systemd to just start your workloads. They've been followed very quickly by Red Hat, who just smelled the coffee and understood that, hey, they needed to play in there. So these are very restricted operating systems with very few things on them, and then all your userland tools, you just put them in Docker containers. So Red Hat has Project Atomic, Ubuntu has Ubuntu Core, which shipped on Azure first. So I have a whole tutorial about how to launch Ubuntu Core on Azure, and how to develop, I don't even remember how they call their packages, but they have a different packaging mechanism for Ubuntu Core. Photon is 2 days old, so I haven't had time to launch it yet or to play with it. I don't think it runs on Azure yet anyway, so that's not the topic for today. Rancher OS is the most interesting one to me, because these guys went to the end of that logic where in their operating system, there's just the Linux kernel and two Docker daemons, one for system Docker, where you run all your operating system services in Docker containers in privileged mode, and then userland Docker, where you run your user workloads, like in CoreOS. So Rancher OS, to me, very interesting. Yesterday, they launched a new load balancer service that seems pretty useful. So really interesting approach there. And I know when I was at Microsoft, we were talking to them to see if they could come on Azure. So I hope there will be an announcement at Build or something like that. That would be suitable. So in the center of the ecosystem, you have Docker itself. And Docker grew a lot in the past, we're talking in the past 5 months. So at DockerCon, which was in December, in addition to Docker, which is the client and the server and the engine, there's been several projects that have been announced, like Docker Machine, Docker Compose, and Swarm. I'll talk about them in details. On the left here, you have a whole ecosystem of startup companies who are saying, oh, Docker has issues to do this or to do that. We'll just provide the solution for that new Docker world. And so two of them are pretty interesting. ClusterHQ, they provide something called Flucker. I'll talk about it in details. That lets you move volume from one host to another. And the other one is Weave Networks, which is a virtual networking layer for Docker containers. And then on the right, you have all the orchestration engines. And there, this is really where we're in a big aquarium with lots of different fish with different shapes and different sizes. So I'll try to give you, the goal here of this talk is to give you an overview of all the orchestration solutions and then show you a few of them that are running on Azure so that you can get started with that. Because very quickly when your developers have gone to the limit of using just Docker Machine, your apps will want to start managing whole clusters for that. So in there, in the orchestration solution, you have Docker Swarm, which is the native orchestration solution from Docker. Mesos, which is coming from Twitter and is more mature. It's running in production in lots of places. Kubernetes, which is coming from Google and has lots of momentum. Deis, which is an open source orchestration engine that runs really well on Azure. Actually, I'm rebooting it right now. I hope it works when the VMs come back up. So DS, which is gives you a Heroku-style workflow for your developers, where you do git push for your code. It pushes to DS, and DS is compiling your code, provisioning it on several nodes, and you can scale them up with a command line, and doing the load balancing for you, and the health management and all that. So that's kind of the Docker ecosystem in a nutshell. So we talked about that. So Docker itself, who knows Docker here? Who has used it already? Okay, so since the majority of people have used it, I'll kind of skip on the basics and we'll go to the more cluster type of stuff. So Docker, essentially, you can think about it as a container for your software. It gives you an isolation, but it's done at an isolation layer, but it's done at the operating system level, and so there's no virtual machine running another operating system on top of it. And so it's much faster. And as everything that's faster, when you change the experience and make something 10 or 100 times faster, the nature of the operation that you're doing is changing. And to me, that's really what drew me to Docker. Initially, I was playing a lot with Hyper-V VMs, like moving them to Azure. Oh, let's download these 2 GB VMs and upload it to Azure. Maybe I'll just go buy a coffee. What's good is that in Seattle, you have really good coffee, but for a developer, it's always frustrating. With Docker, it's like a Docker run. If the container is cached locally, it's super fast, and the images are much smaller. They're layered, so they can be cached. The layers can be cached individually. So there's really a speedy aspect to it. Then, in terms of technology, the isolation is in Docker is given to you by primitives in the Linux kernel, which are namely namespaces and C groups. So you have namespaces for the volumes you mount, the processes that you're running, the network, and these namespaces let you like create a private environment for a process you want to launch. And C groups give you some control over these processes that you are launching, where you can say, oh, this process, I wanted to have only 1 gig of RAM available. If it's going over, you just kill it. You can limit the CPU for it, the I/O, and the devices it has access to. And the result of this is what is called Linux containers. And what Docker is, it's a simple system to let you build in an easy way these containers based on namespaces and C groups. Before that, it existed. Like, Google has been running that forever. I think it's been open sourced in 2006 as LXC. But LXC was super hard to use, and you needed to be really well-versed into hardcore engineering to use it. Docker kind of made it accessible to the masses. Pretty much like what the Netscape browser did compared to the browsers, to the initial browser that Tim Berners-Lee wrote as a command line. So when you're a developer, what does, I'd like to know as well what kind of development background you're coming from. So how many Java developers here? Okay, just a few. .NET? Oh, very good. We're in Seattle. Python? Oh, very good. That's awesome. That's much higher than usual. Node.js, maybe? Excellent. Okay. So a lot of the examples I'm giving here are in Java. I have a few examples in Python as well. So that's what a Docker file looks like. A Docker file is a declarative format to build your image, where your software will be in. And so what you have in a Docker file, you have a from declaration where you can inherit an existing Docker image that has been created by someone else, or by people in your platform group, in your company, or by Docker itself, who's managing some official images. So here I'm inheriting the official Java image, and I can specify a version, 7 or 8, depending on which version of Java I want. Then you have the copy directive here, where you can say, copy what's in the current directory where I'm coding into that directory inside of the container. Then you can specify a working directory where the command that you're specifying afterwards will be executed. Then you have your run command, which is what is going to be run. And the command, which is like the default, if your Docker run doesn't have any argument, is going to run that command by default. So once you've built that Docker file into the root of your project, you can say docker build minus t with a name, and that will build a Docker image out of your code base following these instructions. Once you've done that, you can log into the Docker Hub, you can create an account on Docker Hub, and you can push your image over there, and other developers can pull them. And then you can run your container with a Docker run, and you can assign it a name, so that's essentially it. So that's your developer workflow. You're building your container image, and then you run it. You can even compile your app inside of a container. So for example, instead of having your developers read a very long README on their start day, and at the end of the day, maybe they can compile your code base, with containers, you just put a Docker file at the top of your source code control. They just pull from Git, or they do a Git clone of your code base when they join. And the first thing they do is that they build the image, and they can compile inside of it, and they have everything in there. So for a lot of people and a lot of developers, Docker is kind of replacing the long readmes and automating them. Very quickly, when you're building a modern application based on microservices, you're going to split your application in 3, 4, 5 to 100 services. And when you want to do development on these, launching a Docker run like 5 times for the different services that your app is composed of is very painful and takes time and all that. In order to automate that, we have another project called Docker Compose, where you have a format called the Docker Compose YAML format that's documented on the Docker documentation, where you can essentially explain what your application will be based on, like the name of the container. So here I have a web container and a Redis container. The web container is going to be my front end. It's a Python application. So I just tell it, hey, when you want to build this image, you build taking the code that's in there. The command to run is a Python app.py. You're going to open these ports and map them to from the outside to the container. You're going to attach a volume to it, so you can mount a volume from your host to into the container. And you're going to do a link, so that's a links, to the Redis container. And the name of the link will be Redis. So what that means is that now in my web application, I can just hard code Redis to talk to the Redis host. And wherever I run that compose file, Redis will just give me access to the Redis instance that's running in the other container. And then once I have this compose file, I just run Docker compose up, and it will just start it up, start the two containers, link them together, so I don't need to worry about that. So that kind of really eases developer workflow. So Docker evolved a lot in the past year. What it is now, it's a platform to build, ship, and run an app and run it anywhere. Several projects, so Docker Engine is the main engine that you're running on your VMs. And then you use the Docker client to talk to it. Docker Hub is the hosted service that Docker hosts, where you can create a user and then you can push your images over there. By default, they're public, but we have a service where you can pay. Hey, we're a private company, we need to make money. So you have a private service, you have a service where you can buy subscriptions for getting private repositories there. And if you're a big enterprise who want to standardize on Docker, we have an offering for you called Docker Hub Enterprise that's still in private beta. It's not out there yet, but if you're interested, just ping me, where you can install Docker Hub behind the firewall. And then you can manage the containers the way you want. Then there's Docker Machine that Ahmed talked about, and I'll show you how it works. Docker Machine is one of my favorites. It's because I spend lots of time provisioning VMs in Azure and other clouds. And Docker Machine lets me provision VMs in different places, different clouds, different providers, different virtualization infrastructures like VMware, Hyper-V, VirtualBox, but also on Azure and Google and Amazon. And it will provision a VM to my specs and install a Docker daemon on it. So it's the fastest way to get started with Docker. Then there's Docker Compose. I told you about that. Docker Swarm is the orchestration solution native to Docker. And then there's Catmatic, which is a UI for Docker. And that's really a fun thing where I didn't know about Catmatic at the time. I think it hadn't been acquired by Docker yet. A few months ago, I gave a talk at Microsoft to my colleagues in the DX department to show them how Docker works. And after half an hour on the terminal on the command line, they told me, hey, there's no UI for this stuff. Are you obliged to be in that terminal window on a Mac? And I said, yeah, that's how Docker works. Catmatic is kind of the solution to that. It's a very nice UI to wrap Docker and for people who don't want to go in the terminal. So Docker is a huge community. Lots of companies and individuals are participating into it, and like it's growing like wildfire. We're a small company. We're 130 engineers. We're hiring in San Francisco mainly for now. And it's all about DevOps. To me, Agile was introduced by Ken Beck like in 99 or 2000 or something like so 15 years ago. It took 10 years for Agile to really get into every company and every most developers today are using some form of Agile. And to me, DevOps is just a continuation of that for ops. So it's developers and ops working together in a constant feedback loop to ship faster and have a better workflow. And so Docker containers are kind of the ideal unit of currency for DevOps. This is the thing that Dev and Ops are collaborating about. And it's pretty neatly defined who does what. So developers are working on their code. They specify the libraries that they depend on. They package all that stuff with their data into an image. And then they pass that image to the ops, who are configuring logging, remote access, network configuration, monitoring, and orchestration of these containers into a production infrastructure. So that's quite a very neat separation of roles between the two there. So now let's talk about the ecosystem. So there's a bunch of companies doing interesting stuff with Docker. Weave is an interesting one where right now when you're provisioning containers on different hosts, they cannot talk to each other. You can link different containers on the same host, but not on different hosts. And very quickly, when you build large applications, especially when you're using orchestration engines, you cannot use links that way. And Weave kind of provides a solution to that, where they provide you a virtual networking infrastructure where you can say, this will be my virtual network on top of the existing network that connects the different Docker engines. And then I'm going to launch like maybe 100 containers on that machine and 100 on this other machine. I assign them IP addresses in Weave. They have a DNS service where you can address like DNS names. And then you can use these DNS names or IP addresses, virtual IP address names, into the containers themselves to talk to each other. So that's a pretty nice solution. And it's important to me because when I was trying to make Kubernetes work on Azure, Kubernetes requires, Kubernetes assigns one IP address per pod. And so you need several IP addresses on the same machine. So you need a whole subnet per machine, per VM. And in Azure, every VM get only one IP address. So you need some kind of virtual networking to manage that. And so there's been several solutions. Jeff Mendoza documented a way to use OpenVPN on Ubuntu to make that work. I don't know if his documentation still works today. I haven't tried it in a while. And the Weave guys, I worked with them to make it work on top of CoreOS. So it's Weave, CoreOS, and Kubernetes to make that work on Azure. And it's all documented in the Kubernetes code base. Sorry? And Weave is open source, yeah. And Weave is actually built by the guys who built Rabbit before, like Alexey Richardson, who used to work at VMware. So it's open source, you can just get it from their GitHub repo. They have lots of documentation and they're playing with lots of interesting players. Flockr is also an interesting player, it's also open source. So it's made by a startup called ClusterHQ. What they address is, and we're always going back to that notion of cluster, where when you start to have lots of containers, some of them will have a database associated to a Docker volume. And when you mount a Docker volume, it's mounted from the host on which your engine is running. And what happens if you're in an orchestration solution that has like 10,000 machines, and at one point it says, oh, I'm going to shut down this machine and that container there where your precious database is, I'm going to move it to host number two. Flockr is solving that problem where they intercept the call when we want to move the container. And what they do is that they're using ZFS behind the scene. So ZFS is a file system from Solaris that was ported to Linux. And ZFS has very fast snapshotting. So they take a snapshot of the file system for the volume. Then they move that snapshot to the other host, and that can take a few hours. If you have a large database, that can take a long time. But your application continues to run during that time. Once the snapshot has moved, then they stop your application, and they move the diff between the snapshot and what was moved there. So it's like two-phase commit. They move the diff, and then they say, okay, you can kill this guy, and I restart it on the other side. So it's a pretty nice solution there. What happens if you lose your host hardware for the volume? So ZFS, because it has snapshotting, you should always do backups of that stuff. So if you lose the host for your data, for sure you should have a backup of that. But what they're addressing is not the solution of doing backups. It's more about the solution of what do I do with a stateful container that needs to be orchestrated somewhere else. And that will happen a lot in large operations. And so right now, Docker doesn't have a plugin system. So Docker is built in Go, it's a statically compiled language, and there's no plugin system in Docker. And so what they did in order to make it work, they built a project called PowerStrip that's open source, pretty interesting stuff. It acts as a proxy between the Docker client and the Docker server. It intercepts the API request, and then it calls Weave or Flocker or whatever plugin you want to build in there before calling the, and then they can mess up with the payload before it goes to the Docker engine, and they do that on the other side as well. And right now we're working with them to build a real plugin system for production for Docker. So let's talk about orchestration. So the first orchestration I want to talk about is Docker Swarm. So that's the native orchestration from Docker. It's pretty simple to use and simple to set up. It's using the same API as Docker. And essentially it lets you take several Docker engines who are running on different hosts and assemble together into what we call a swarm. So Swarm just is a front end to all these engines, and as a developer in the client, that can be on your Mac or on Windows, you just talk to the Swarm engine, and then Swarm talks to the various containers, and it says, hey, anybody has some room for that container? Or, hey, I have a container that needs to run on SSD. Can you schedule that for me? And then there's one container that happens to have SSD on them, so it will be scheduled in there. There's one engine that has SSD, I mean. So it's like 85% of the Docker REST API, so it's using the same API. It's doing resource management for you, CPU, memory, and networking. It's doing scheduling with constraints and affinities. And for the backend for Swarm, for storing metadata and all that, like the IP addresses of the various engines that are part of a Swarm, it's pluggable. So by default, it's going to Docker Hub, but you can plug etcd, console, zookeeper, whatever you want. And it's secure. That's what Ahmed was saying. There's a bunch of certificates somewhere that needs to be configured. Hopefully, Swarm is working with machine. So when you use machine to configure Swarm, you never see these certificates. So that's what I'm using, because those drove me crazy. Okay, so that's what it looks like. Maybe I should show you. So you do a Swarm create. That creates a token for your Swarm cluster. And then for nodes in the cluster, you do Swarm join with the node IP and the token. And what Swarm join does is that it takes the node IP, puts that into Docker Hub to say, hey, this guy is part of this swarm. So it's like a big map saying, for this token, I have this list of IP addresses. And then you launch a Swarm manager with Swarm manage and that token to say, this is the guy who's going to be the master for all these guys. So for resource management, so when you talk to a Swarm server, you can say Docker run minus M, I want 1 gigabyte of RAM for that container. I want a machine that has at least one gigabyte of RAM. You can assign constraints. For example, you can say, hey, I want to run that container. This one is for QA, and I really want to QA on different operating systems, so I want to run it into a machine that's running Fedora, or a machine that has this storage driver, or a machine that has SSD, and you can use labels for that, or that is in this region. You have affinities as well, where you can put containers together or separate them out. For example, you want your front end to be separate from your database backends. So you can say, oh, I want this to be close to that container, to be on the same host, or to be on different hosts. And so the way this Swarm scheduler is working is that first, it's excluding the nodes using filters like port. Is the port 80 available on that machine? If not, I'm going to try another one. It's using labels. It's using the health check to say, oh, this engine doesn't respond. Maybe I won't schedule anything in there. And then it picks a strategy to provision the best node to say, so it has a bunch of strategies like random, bin pack, or spread, but you can code your own. And it's integrating with machine. It's partially integrated with Compose. I'll try to do a demo. I know it failed yesterday. I'll see if it works today. Some of the demos are working, some not. I'm not sure why. So the integration is partial. I hope by 1.7 it gets better. And then there's some integration with Mesosphere, where Mesos, which is kind of more production grade, they're integrating Swarm with a Mesos framework. They're working on that right now. But that's kind of cutting edge. It's not finished yet. One of the things that Swarm does not do, compared to other orchestration engines like Kubernetes, which has services to do load balancing, is it's not doing load balancing for you. So once you provision your host, once you provision your container, it's provisioned on one of the Docker engines. But then you need, for example, in Azure, you would need to create an endpoint to be for that container to be accessible from the outside. And you want to do that automatically. There's a pretty cool project by one of my colleagues who's working on machine, Evan Hazlett, called Interlock, that has an HA proxy plugin where you can configure HA proxy to listen to Docker Swarm events. So when you're talking to a Docker engine, it generates a bunch of events, and you can plug on that event stream. And so what you do is that you plug HA proxy to the event stream of the Docker Swarm, and then it can listen to where containers are scheduled, and then it's going to change the load balancing that it's doing automatically, and there's a bunch of environment variables to configure that. So that project is pretty cool. I just learned about it like yesterday. I haven't tried it yet. So Mesos is kind of production grade. It comes from Twitter. It's run by lots of companies right now. So it's been proven there's a whole zoo, another ecosystem. So they don't represent that as a zoo because their logo is not a whale. They represent that as periodic table of elements. But there's lots of stuff to learn in there and lots of development in there. But at the high level, they have this notion of a framework, which is a scheduler plus an executor. The scheduler is the piece that gets resources offered from the cluster, and the executor is the piece that's running tasks. And so they have several scheduler like a Marathon or Hadoop. And right now, they're building a Docker Swarm framework where you'll be able, with the same Docker client, to talk to a Mesos cluster, and it will feel like a Swarm. If they already have orchestration in Mesos, why are they building another orchestration with Swarm? And the answer to that, I think you should ask that to a Mesos representative, but I'll give you my opinion on that. It's really that Mesos was really designed to run Hadoop workloads or workloads in specific languages with their frameworks. And right now, the unit of orchestration is becoming the container. And so that's important for them to be part of that world and to be able to start scheduling containers from the Docker client that the developers are using into a Mesos cluster. So I think it totally makes sense from a business point of view on their side to do that. Another aspect, so another orchestration slash operating system option is CoreOS. How many of you have tried CoreOS? Okay, so a few, that's good. So CoreOS runs really well on Azure. I'll show you a demo of that. CoreOS, it's a minimal Linux distribution. There's basically etcd, which is a distributed key value pair using the RAF protocol to do synchronization. And Docker to provision workloads, and they have built something called Fleet that's doing orchestration. And then very typically people are running Kubernetes on top of that. And I told you that market was moving very fast. Google invested in them, and they did a joint announcement for a common product. I don't remember how they call that, but basically it's Kubernetes on CoreOS, sold by CoreOS, and it's kind of the Google hybrid story in there. So they have Fleet that lets you orchestrate services. I'll show you how that works. It's all based on etcd, so it's just storing a bunch of stuff in etcd for configuring all your services. It's using etcd for service discovery. And there are lots of cluster architecture, and I have a whole... So there, I created this GitHub project, github.com/chanaison/azure-linux. Here I have a bunch of very detailed tutorial about how to set up a CoreOS cluster on Azure for production or for development. So that's the kind of CoreOS, how you can set up different types of clusters. For production, you would put all your etcd in a separate cluster and then have all your machines running workloads on a separate one. And I have also a tutorial about how to deploy a simple Java app using MongoDB on CoreOS on Azure. Is CoreOS perceived as competition by Docker? Is that kind of summarizes it? I'd say yes and no. Yes, in the case that like CoreOS is building a distribution, they add services like etcd and Fleet. They created their own container format called AppC and their own container runtime called Rocket. And now they're doing this integration with Kubernetes. So on one side, you can see them wanting to compete with Docker on that side. On the other hand, I think the perception at Docker is more that CoreOS is one part of the ecosystem. A lot of early adopters for Docker are running Docker on CoreOS. Myself, I did all my experimentation on Azure initially on CoreOS, and I was just running Docker there. So to me, they're just one part of the ecosystem. And they're innovating, they're creating lots of things, and I think everybody in that ecosystem is just trying to solve the same problem, which is to make developers and ops more productive. And so there are many approaches to that. Docker is pretty opinionated in its approaches, CoreOS as well. We'll see what people decide to use on one side or the other. But to me, today, CoreOS just runs Docker inside them, so that's a good ecosystem partner for that. How is Flannel different from Weave? So CoreOS has one other project that's called Flannel. That's actually excellent. It's virtual networking, but at the CoreOS level. So to make your CoreOS instances, to install Kubernetes on CoreOS, you can use Flannel as well as Weave. And this is documented on the Kubernetes documentation. I tried it and I failed on Azure. I think there were some issues in their cloud init file. So when it failed on Azure, I tried it on Amazon as well, and it didn't work either. I logged a bug against Kubernetes for that. In the cloud init file, they had and this is the kind of stuff where you spend 2 days, why doesn't it work? And then you realize, oh, they're missing a dash. There was just one dash missing. And the result of that is that when you were rebooting your machine, so it worked the first time, you provisioned the cluster, but when you rebooted the machine, it didn't work anymore. And the problem is that it wasn't idempotent, so when the thing wasn't restarting the second time, it just barfed on it, and nothing worked after that. Does things like virtual networking like Flannel pose a threat to Azure? And the answer to me is no, to the contrary. Things like Flannel, Docker, and CoreOS are excellent for Azure because Azure is providing you the underlying infrastructure that's rock solid. And if you run CoreOS and Flannel and Docker, I met a guy at the Azure meetup in San Francisco yesterday who was running that kind of workloads. I think he was running on CoreOS. He wasn't using Flannel, he was using Docker on the new G series from Azure. Like, you know, these monster machines with 400 gigs of RAM and SSD drives, and he was doing like scientific computing on it. Like, for Azure, that's all great to have this guy on the platform. If it was all Windows Server, it just wouldn't happen. So I don't think that's a danger. To the contrary, just bringing more people in the platform. If you make it easy for people to build hybrid clouds, where they have a part of the workloads that are in their private cloud and a part that are on public cloud, is it bad for the public clouds? Yeah, so that summarizes it well. To me, I really don't think so. I think to the contrary, that's what enterprises want. And I think the condition that they have to start using more public cloud services is that you provide them that mobility. And so things like Docker, CoreOS, or Flannel are all going into that direction where they're going to start building their private clouds internally, and then more and more workloads are going to move to the public cloud because the infrastructure will be cheaper and better because it's run at scale and there are economies of scale there that you just cannot do internally. So there may be some regulatory reasons for you to keep your stuff internally, or maybe it's like super sensitive data that you really don't want out. But for more and more workloads, I really think that they're going to move towards public clouds. So to me, that movement towards portability is actually great for public clouds. Well, what are my thoughts on flannel versus weave? It's like Ubuntu versus Red Hat. I don't know. It depends on your taste and how they fit with your requirements and what you want to do. I don't have any specific opinion there. Yeah, I've played with a lot of these technologies, but I don't read in the tea leaves in there about like which one. Docker, I really felt that, oh, this really changes the game. It's going to be successful. Flannel versus Weave, I don't know. I think Weave is much more fully featured for having played with it. Flannel seemed much simpler. But that's just my like experience playing with it for like a few weeks. There's another orchestration engine called DS. Maybe I'll just switch quickly through the slides and then show you some demos, because that's more interesting. But the slides kind of give you a context for the demos. So DS gives you a workflow that's very similar to what you have on Heroku, where you just create your app in Java. For example, you use the Java build pack, and then you push your code, you do git push of your code, and Heroku is going to build it for you and run it for you. They added support for containers in there, so you can push a Docker file or push an image in there. And they're going to take care of everything for you, which is they have a router mesh that's doing load balancing for you. You can plug your DNS and have it point to it, and then you can push lots of application. I'll show you an example where I took a domain I own called shabazz.name, where I pointed it to my DS installation, and then I can just push applications and containers to it, and it's just going to create a foobar.shabazz.name, and each application will have its own name in there. And Fleet is based on top of CoreOS and on top of etd. So there's the router, and they have a health manager, so when one of the machines dies, it just moves the container to another machine. You're supposed to build what is called 12-factor apps. So it's a paper by Heroku that, about the style of apps that are stateless, where you're using cloud services for your persistence layer. Then there's Kubernetes, which is that open source project from Google. Kubernetes, let me just say, they have a little bit more concepts than the other orchestration engines. So they, in addition, so they have a container agent on each machine, and the scheduler schedules containers in there. But also have this notion of pod, which is pretty interesting. It's pretty much like the Compose format, where you say, I want to have these three microservices always scheduled together. And so in Kubernetes, what you deploy is a pod, and these pods are the unit of scheduling in there. They have this notion of replication controller that's going to schedule your pods, and they also have this notion of labels that actually have been added to Docker in 1.6. So if you download the latest Docker, you'll get labels as well. And these labels let you specify, hey, there's going to be they have labels and services. And services are the layer that's doing the load balancing for you. And so you associate your pods to specific services. And the services with labels, you can have a label for prod and one for staging. And then you have a command line called kubectl, to just provision your containers. One last word about like my previous passion, which is Cloud Foundry. What I found super interesting, that Cloud Foundry was the path that was open source, that provided you that portability layer, but it had some limitation. It had some limitation for the developer in the kind of stuff they could run in there. And Cloud Foundry reinvented themselves as a Docker orchestration engine. And so they have this project called Diego that orchestrates containers. And another project called Lattice that lets you run a smaller subset of Cloud Foundry on your laptop or in the cloud, but just really specific to containers. IBM is reinventing themselves as well. They have this Bluemix platform that's built on top of three technologies: OpenStack, Docker, and Cloud Foundry. And the slides are online, they're on SlideShare, so you can download them today, SlideShare/Chenezon. And all my demos that I wanted to show you that you can do at home on Azure, they're on Chenezon/Azure Linux, and it's very detailed. You can go through them, and it's pretty easy.